Hair color was also important. Blonde was considered the ideal hair color. Ladies' magazines of the time declared blondes were the only true beauties. Other colors could be nice or handsome, but only blondes were worth talking about. This lady here, in George Goodwin Kilburn's painting, would be considered nearly ideal. The chin isn't really there, as it gently fades into the neck. The face is a long oval and the eyes rounded and china blue. Her hair is blonde and slightly curly. Slightly curly is important here. Too curly and she seems wild and unrulable, but slightly curly gives the idea of yielding and gentle with no severity. The hands are small, the arms taper, the neck is not thick or short, and her chest is defined but not overwhelming. Lacking pointing or jutting features of any kind, this lady's only flaw may be that her nose is too straight and strong, giving her too much of a classical profile. However, her blonde hair, round blue eyes, and cupid bow lips come very close to the stereotypical standard of Victorian beauty. Another canon of Victorian beauty, one not as beautiful as the blonde canon, but still a lovely lady, was the auburn-haired beauty. Auburn hair, to any reader of Anne of Green Gables, may seem to be a very red-headed type color, but in this era it was a brown hair color that glowed with reddish warmth, rather than simply being a dark red. The auburn-haired woman was considered almost beautiful by Victorian standards. She needed an ample chest, though that was never quite nearly enough to counteract her misfortune of not being blonde. She should have a tapered waist, but a good corset could help with that. And as with the blonde standard, she should also have small hands and tiny feet, not seen in James Tissot's painting, and tapering arms. In Tissot's Young Lady in a Boat, his model has a gentle chin and rounded oval face. Here, compared to Kilburn's painting, the eyes are more almond. She's simply not as beautiful. Her character would be considered in keeping with her eye and hair, possibly a little on the saucy side, but still upstanding. The auburn-haired woman could be handsome. The last kind of woman in Victorian society was the dark-haired woman. They could never be beautiful. If her skin was lily enough, her neck long enough, her bosom ample enough, her waist thin enough, her hands small enough, her disposition gentle enough, she could be considered striking. The dark-haired woman required a gentle nature and pale complexion to be considered attractive. The auburn-haired woman needed a quick wit. The blonde woman could be effortlessly beautiful. Of course, all of these beauty standards hung on more than just hair color. Bone structure, skin tone, and other things were part of the equation. But there is a hair color that isn't on this list. The red-headed woman. Even just calling someone a red-headed woman was like calling someone a bad name. It was either a social call-out that either meant you were a mean-spirited cat, or the woman you were speaking out about was your worst enemy. It was a mean girl's ostracizing call to arms. But you might say after a Google search, red-headed women show up a lot in Victorian art. And this is partially true. Redheads were featured in a lot of art created during the Victorian era, but they are not, strictly speaking, featured in Victorian art. There was a subculture of art that rebelled against the beauty standards of the Victorian and created art that celebrated what the mainstream deemed ugly. In the paintings of these artists, you'll find sharp chins and elbows, bony bodies, hooked noses, wild hair, and red locks streaming untamed around the thin, long bodies of the women painted. These rebels began with a small group of painters in London who went by a not-so-secret name, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. During a visit to the Royal Academy exhibition of 1848, the young artist and poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti was drawn to a painting entitled The Eve of St. Agnes by William Holman Hunt. As a subject taken from the poetry of John Keats was a rarity of the time, Rossetti sought out Hunt and the two quickly became friends. Hunt then introduced Rossetti to his friend John Everett Millais, and the rest, as they say, is history. The trio went on to form the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, a group determined to reform the artistic establishment of Victorian England. The name, Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, or PRB, hints at the vaguely medieval subject matter for which the group is known. The young artists appreciated the simplicity of line and large flat areas of brilliant color found in the early Italian painters before Raphael, as well as in the 15th century Flemish art. They were not qualities favored by the more academic approach taught at the Royal Academy during the mid-19th century, which stressed the strong light and dark shading of the old masters. Another source of inspiration for the young artists was the writing of the art critic John Ruskin, particularly the famous passage from Modern Painters telling artists to go to nature in all singleness of heart, rejecting nothing, selecting nothing, and scorning nothing. This combination of influences contributed to the group's extreme attention to detail and the development of the wet white ground technique that produced the brilliant color for which they are known. The artists even became some of the first to complete sections of their canvases outdoors in an effort to capture the minute detail of every leaf and blade of grass. It was decided that 7 was the appropriate number for a rebellious group, and 4 others were added to form the initial brotherhood. The selection of additional members has long mystified art historians. James Collinson, a painter, seems to have been added due to his short-lived engagement to Rossetti's sister, Christina, rather than with his sympathy with the cause. Another member, Thomas Woolner, was a sculptor rather than a painter. The final 2 members, William Michael Rossetti and Frederick George Stevens, both of whom went on to become art critics, were not practicing artists. However, other young artists, such as Walter Howell Deverill and Charles Collins, embraced the ideals of the PRB even though they were never formally elected as members.